From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Anonymous offensive speech poses significant challenges at Colgate and other colleges and universities, and state residents and many state legislators are unhappy that public flagship universities are admitting more out-of-state students. Hi, this is Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation today, please note you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. In our first segment today, we're going to talk about anonymous offensive speech. The anonymous posting feature provided by some social media applications present major challenges to colleges and universities and to campus leaders. Add ominous comments on sites such as Rate My Professors or racist, sexist, or homophobic comments posted on various social apps seem to demand a formal institutional response. Data from the 2014 Campus Computing Survey of CIOs suggests that about one-fifth of four-year colleges and universities experience an IT security issue, often cyber-stalking or cyberbullying, related to the student use of social media. At Colgate University this fall, a student sit-in was prompted in part by anonymous racist messages posted on Yik Yak and other social media. Other institutions have reported similar problems with anonymous offensive postings on social apps. The experience at Colgate and elsewhere raises the question about an institutional obligation to monitor and to respond to anonymous messaging on social media. What are the appropriate and what are the effective institutional responses? Joining us for this conversation are Sean Decatur, a chemist by training who is the president of Kenyon College in Ohio. Eric Stoller is a social media strategist and writes the Student Affairs and Technology blog for Inside Higher Ed. And Scott Jasek is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Sean Decatur, let me turn to you. You're a college president. You wrote about this recently in Inside Higher Ed in an opinion piece. And in fact, in that opinion piece, you wrote, quote, Yik Yak is the app du jour for racist, sexist, and homophobic comments. Do institutions have an obligation to monitor social media for offensive language and postings? And is there an institutional responsibility to respond?
I think that institutions have the responsibility of being aware of what's being posted online, of being on alert, especially for comments which are aimed to inflame the community or that are run counter to the community's values, but probably most importantly for comments that raise questions or concerns about student safety on campus. So that includes comments that are aimed or targeted at particular students, or what we've seen at times are comments of students who are anonymously reaching out on via social media because they are in crisis in some way. And so, you know, in those cases, we also have obligations to make sure that the folks in the community are aware of both the community standards and also are aware of resources available for support on campus.
So this institution, Sean, in a very different way, typically it's a reactive. I mean, if there's an institutional obligation to respond for offensive speech, for potentially violent speech, for speech that says something about the mental health of an individual student, perhaps as we saw in Santa Barbara earlier this year before the tragic shootings, this puts institutions in essentially in an anticipatory mode. We have to find this before it happens. Is that a fair summary?
I think that it is. You know, our approach has been making sure that we get information out on the you know what resources and support are available on campus. And as an example, not Yik Yak, but there are a range of other anonymous social media postings and sites that that students use at Kenyon and elsewhere. Some of our peer counselors are, monitor and participate in those sites, and if they see postings that suggest that a student is reaching out for help, the peer counselors will, respond immediately with information and as an attempt to to try to actually reach out to that student and see if that student will, in not in a public forum, but in a quiet way, make contact with a peer counselor.
Eric Stewart, you too have written about Yik Yak in one of your blog posts at Inside Higher Ed, Student Affairs and Technology, and you said Yik Yak is very different because of the geofencing feature. Can you talk with us a little bit about that in terms of how this differentiates Yik Yak and potentially makes it more disturbing or more offensive because of that geofencing or other aspects of the application?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I know, as Sean mentioned, you know, we've had, there's various sites out there, various social media platforms. You know, we've got Juicy Campus to Rate My Professor to, you know, Facebook confession pages and people using Tumblr for sort of these anonymous things. And I think the sort of key differentiator with Yik Yak especially is that aspect of mobility and the fact that it's actually targeted for your exact location. You know, it's 1.5 miles is the circular area that which Yik Yak says, okay, you post from this space, you're actually posting within this space. It's not I'm in the West Coast talking about someone who happens to be in New York or vice versa. You know, you're actually talking about someone who's got some proximity to you. And I think that proximity element is to me what makes sort of that combination of anonymity plus proximity is where we get into trouble. And I think that's where Yik Yak, to me anyway, as a platform, it represents the good, the bad, and the ugly of social communications. And that element, though, of people having the ability to say something via their phone in a public space that then someone else could pop open their phone, look at the app, and say, oh, wow, someone just said something terrible about me, and I have no idea out of the 20 or so people in the crowd that are near me who just said this. And I think that's the point that we still haven't figured out yet in terms of what we're going to do about this technology, because at face value, it looks great. Being able to communicate with a population or a community that's actually near you is a really cool piece of functionality. I just think we haven't figured out sort of socially how to be responsible with it and to sort of remain civil.
Let me push a little bit this out, Eric, because it sounds like one of the things that differentiates Yik Yak is that with Facebook or other social media, I give permission to access to different groups. With this geofencing feature in Yik Yak, as you've described it, suggests that, in fact, it's not permission to groups or individuals I might know, but it's that, can we monitor your location when you use the app and then blow out whatever you write to the people within that 1.5 mile radius? Is that correct?
Well, I think that's the thing. I mean, there's nothing that's anonymous in general. I mean, there was the student at the University of Central Oklahoma who posted a threatening post on Yik Yak, and they called him Yaks. And it went, you know, it escalated, and it went all the way to campus police, and they ended up pursuing, you know, legal action towards this particular student because Yik Yak, even though it says it's anonymous, is participating with law enforcement, just like other apps like Snapchat, which is, you know, all about sort of ephemeral posts. They're all participating with law enforcement, so there's nothing really anonymous about it, but the element of, you know, that's where, you know, the whole article that Sean wrote about Yik Yak being a platform for sort of non-civil discourse, you know, it comes to fruition when you've got people in a classroom, for example, saying nasty things at strangers, you know, people that they don't know, and it's intimidation language, it's hate speech, and that's sort of sprinkled in through the app. I think the problem is where it's really hard to talk about this in sort of a nuanced perspective because we immediately go to the things that people post that generate controversy or that interest law enforcement. And there's been all sorts of things that people have been posting on Yik Yak that are just about their daily lives, just like they do on other social platforms like Facebook or Twitter. And then you'll see people say, you know, I'm homesick. And you'll see people say, oh, you know, hey, we are too. There's this event happening on campus. You can attend it. You know, hey, maybe you won't be so homesick. And I think that's the kind of thing where this app has benefit. But again, something happens when you introduce anonymity and proximity. And people just say, you know, if you go into Yik Yak and just sort of randomly surf through various campuses, and you can actually do that with the app, you can go to a campus and just look at what people are saying. There's just a lot of ugly stuff that people are posting.
Scott, anonymous offensive speech is not new. I mean, period, you know, almost every fall in the wake of a fraternity party someplace, some institution reports inappropriate behavior. Yet the social media angle on this seems to elevate it in some very significant ways.
Yes, and I'd say in addition to anonymous online speech not being new, neither are racial tensions on campus. And so if you look at this year, Colgate Yik Yak was one of the issues, but so were a lot of other things. Syracuse University having a debate over whether they're doing enough to recruit minority students, Bryn Mawr College just having a huge debate over students who are flying the Confederate flag. And so I look at these online tools coming into a higher ed system where there are already racial tensions. We're approaching the end of October, which is historically a time for offensive parties from many in higher education that have racial or ethnic themes that will then get posted on social media. So the difficulty that unfortunately many students have getting along, respecting students from different cultures, none of that's new. On the other hand, those issues haven't gone away. And so I see Yik Yak making them more prominent and more personally threatening to individuals than, say, seeing a random offensive graffiti somewhere on campus.
Sean, I want to come back to the sort of the typology that you almost laid out for us. There is the offensive or speech, there is the threatening speech, and there is the I'm not doing well speech in one sense. I'm having problems here at Acme College. Again, to the role of institutions and an obligation to monitor, who should be doing that? You mentioned peer counselors at Kenyon.
Right, and you know, I think that there are there's some challenges. You know, one, as Eric mentioned, the proliferation of these types of sites and the types of ways in which students can post things is constantly expanding, and so there is a real challenge that the institution can't watch everything all the time. But I do think that having a mechanisms of making sure that someone is paying attention to the student conversations and the discussions and content going on campus, whether happening through social media or happening through other sources, that information is made available and to the attention of the administration is important to do. You know, I'd also add one other thing that really feeds on what Scott is saying is that the big challenge here for our institutions is to not only respond in a case-by-case or to specific incidents that are happening on social media, but the really big issue is changing culture on campus. You know, and this has been part of the conversation at Kenyon, that, on the one hand, we can press for and make calls for civil discourse on campus for people to not engage in this type of use of social media. But at the same time, we also have to recognize that those behaviors actually reflect some underlying cultural issues which our campuses also need to be aware of and to try to address. And it's that cultural change of making sure that everyone sees that, for example, racist, sexist, homophobic comments are not acceptable on campus, that's a longer-term piece that all of our institutions need to work on.
Well, that seems to be sort of a common institutional response in terms of the reaction at Colgate, which you alluded to at your own campus, Sean. Eric, the underlying theme to all this is when these things happen, we want to see if we can find out who's posting and confront that individual in a safe but appropriate way to say it's inappropriate behavior. And two, is the larger community reaction, which is we need to do user education of some sort. I mean, do those user education conversations have benefit other than just sort of being a palette of response in terms of saying, yes, we're doing something?
I think the sort of biggest indicator that there's a need for, sort of education, digital identity, and sort of how we converse in these spaces is the fact that Yik Yak, for the most part, has voluntarily banned itself from high schools. Because I think that's the indicator that there's a problem here. It's not just colleges and universities and higher education. It's that, this app provides a platform in many ways that just elevates the ability for bullying, which we all, we recognize has been going on for a long time, to almost happen at a different level, and kind of engage sort of this mob mentality. And I think that, to me, the fact that, apps like Twitter or Facebook or other platforms exist in sort of a big picture harmony in high schools and colleges and universities. But Yik Yak saying, you know, we're going to geofence ourselves voluntarily from being able to be accessed by high school students, that says a lot to me about the fact that they know that there's an issue with the app. And I think it's just spreading into colleges and universities because we just don't do enough when it comes to educational efforts around discourse and community building, and just responsibility around what you say face-to-face matters just as much as what you say online or through a mobile app.
Scott, do we do enough? I mean, is this just another one of these things that gets tossed on the checklist of freshman orientation initially as an entering experience as opposed to a reactive experience?
Well, I think actually we probably spend too much time on the wrong question. Right now, there are a lot of colleges debating whether they will, quote, ban Yik Yak. At Bryn Mawr, there are people proposing that the Confederate flag be banned. Now, in public higher education in particular, it's very difficult to ban things, however offensive they are. But particularly when you're looking at the online world, let's say everyone shuts down Yik Yak tomorrow, there will be a next Yik Yak. And so I tend to think that the discussion is better focused on what Eric mentioned and what Sean wrote about. How do you promote civility? However much you ban something you don't like, it's going to come back in a new form, particularly in the current environment where students aren't relying on the college or university to direct them to the online tools they're using. They're using their own tools.
And Sean, in terms of their own tools, I mean, based on your experience at Kenyon, your conversations with other presidents where this has occurred, do these efforts at civility really make a difference, or again, are they palliative?
You know, and I think that, at least from my experience here at Kenyon, it's too early to tell what impact we're having in trying to raise this as an issue. I think part of the larger call for civility, though, has to be something that is embraced by the student, the majority of the student population. It can't be something that is seen as the administration lecturing to the students in order to be successful. I think these approaches have to be education driven, but also driven to get structured in such a way to get students on board, and students really in positions of leadership and expressing their voices on what's important to them about campus discourse.
So let me close then by saying it seems that the real value of this is essentially raising student awareness and change the student culture, as opposed to, as you said, Sean, having adults lecture to students. Is that fair?
Yes, and I think that though that means that that doesn't mean that the administration and the faculty take to the sidelines, but it means that the administration and faculty are working along with students to help students take ownership and to raise their voices on this issue.
Great. Sean Decatur at Kenyon and Eric Stoller, Inside Higher Ed blogger, thank you, as well as Scott, for the very informative conversation that went beyond just the issue of offensive speech, but also went into some of the other nuances of social media and the ways that student behavior begins to play out on screen and in communities. Thank you all. In our second segment today, we'll talk about balancing in-state and out-of-state enrollments and revenues. Public flagship universities in Arizona, Colorado, Indiana, New Hampshire, and Vermont are among those that have a long history of actively recruiting out-of-state students to populate classrooms and provide supplemental operating revenues. Non-resident students may help also to diversify student populations, particularly for institutions in rural areas. But recruiting out-of-state students can present significant political challenges. Alumni and taxpayers may see classroom seats going to non-residents rather than their own children, and members of the state legislature might view out-of-state students as benefiting from state subsidies despite their higher tuition payments. A new funding formula proposed by the Regents at the University of Iowa, where almost half the students are not Iowa residents, places a new emphasis on in-state enrollment and involves significant financial penalties, upwards of $60 million over the next several years, if the university fails to hit target numbers for Iowa residents. Yet the Iowa proposals may also have significant consequences for the state's private colleges and community colleges, which fear enrollment declines if the University of Iowa and the state's two other public universities successfully recruit more state residents. In the larger context, state funding for public universities dropped 23% in real dollars between 2008 and 2013 and is now less than 10% of the operating budget at many public universities. Is there an alternative to the easy money provided by out-of-state students? Joining us for this conversation is Jerry Lucido, who's the Executive Director of the University of Southern California's Center for Enrollment Research, Policy, and Practice. Jerry is also a research professor at USC's Rossiter School of Education, and Scott Jasek, who is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Jerry, let me begin this conversation with you. We know that there's been pushback in lots of states because of rising out-of-state enrollments. The Iowa conversation, as reported by Inside Higher Ed, seems different in that here we've got the pushback coming from others in-state that are affected by the effort of the flagship institutions to recruit in-state. Is the Iowa situation unique?
You know, I don't know that it's unique. I know it's more vocal. I think any time a flagship would take more in-state students, there will be an impact on private colleges that may have gotten the students that they didn't take in the past, and potentially the community colleges, though likely less so. I think the Iowa situation is unique in that there seems to be much more concern expressed by at least some presidents in the state of Iowa of small private colleges. So I think it may be unique. I find it a little bit hard to believe that if Iowa takes more students, this would have a huge impact on some of those other institutions. It seems more that this issue in Iowa is aimed toward redistributing the students among Iowa State and Northern Iowa and the like.
So, Scott, I mean, you cover this. I'm thinking about some small states, New Hampshire, Vermont, where the private colleges, I'm wondering, have they reached a talent with the university about these issues in terms of in-state, out-of-state? Because it doesn't seem to be much of an issue as I think about larger states that also have aggressively recruited out-of-state students and now may be getting some pushback about in-state recruitment.
Well, what you've got here is you have states have different traditions. And so University of Vermont, where there aren't a ton of Vermonters in the state who need a space for higher education, has a long tradition of lots of out-of-state students, and I think it benefits everyone. You've also got institutions like the University of Virginia, UNC Chapel Hill, where legislators very carefully monitor out-of-state enrollments and would be pretty angry if they went up. What we've seen in recent years is something happens, a dynamic in the state changes, and that results in another change. So in California, you have the state withdrew from supporting public higher education, and public higher education decided to look out of state for revenue and students. Similarly, in California some years ago, when the state banned affirmative action, a lot of institutions outside California said, oh, we're going to start recruiting minority students in California. So people don't always realize the extent to which there's really a big ecosystem, and people pay attention to strategies that different institutions pick.
Yeah, so let's talk about that California example. Yesterday's Wall Street Journal featured an article about this issue of out-of-state students. The article is titled, In-State Students Are Out of Luck. It opened citing the experience of the valedictorian at Malibu High School, who was also the varsity quarterback, had a lot of AP exams, and was admitted to Brown but was not admitted to UCLA or USC. I'd rather UCLA, my apologies, or Berkeley. State enrollments, out-of-state enrollments, and also offshore foreign student enrollments have exploded, it would seem, in California. The Wall Street Journal graph suggested that upwards of 40% of the freshmen at Berkeley recently are either non-residents, either that they're out of state or they're foreign students. There is pushback in California. Jerry, where else have you seen pushback on these issues?
Well, I think you're right that there's pushback in California because in California there are issues where theoretically there are enough spaces for all the students who wish to go to a UC campus, but the students will not see some of those campuses as desirable or even remotely like the ones they want to go in. But wherever there's a powerful flagship, we see this kind of pushback. I mean, this is not unusual in this particular situation. You know, to see students who are distinguished students, but who are not able to get into their public institutions. Now, part of this has to do with the broader This happened in North Carolina when I was there, for sure, and it happens elsewhere. It certainly happens in Virginia and elsewhere. There are sort of three things here. I think there's issues of budget, which are making the new issue, which is why we're talking today. The states have retracted their budgets, and the institutions are acting to preserve their quality. There's also the issue of the institutional ambition. These institutions like to compete on a scale with each other and for rankings. And there's the issue of student choice. So all of these come together. The issue that maybe a student, that particular student in the Wall Street Journal got into Brown, it's not clear that that student would have chosen Berkeley necessarily had Berkeley admitted that. As Kat said, this is an interesting ecosystem.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about that ecosystem. Scott, you mentioned this experience in California when a public initiative banned affirmative action in the state, and so other institutions began to pick off talented minority students. We've seen some of this in terms of other things going on in California. The University of Oregon has been doing very well now targeting California students in some ways. And yet, on the other side of this, there seem to be institutions that have a long history of recruiting, happily welcoming out-of-state students. I'm thinking of flagships in Arizona, in Colorado. Scott, you mentioned Vermont and New Hampshire, where maybe this isn't that much of an issue.
Well, a lot of it has to do with how difficult it is to get into the universities and how many high schoolers are graduating who are qualified to enroll. And so if you look at the University of Vermont, if they didn't admit from out of state, it would end up being a much smaller university with fewer academic programs and opportunities for Vermonters. If you look at the University of California system, incredibly high demand to get in and a booming population in the state. So it's important to remember that a few years ago, before UC started admitting all of these students, there were still tons of applicants and parents complaining, my kid unfairly couldn't get into Berkeley, it's as hard to get into Berkeley as into Harvard, and so forth. That didn't start with the out-of-state admissions. The out-of-state admissions are perhaps more visible, but the other reality is that the University of California hasn't grown, and Berkeley certainly hasn't grown, as the state has grown. So some increased difficulty in getting into Berkeley and UCLA really isn't that surprising.
Yeah, I want to come back also to North Carolina. Jerry, you mentioned North Carolina, and I think Scott did as well, as a state that historically has capped and carefully monitored. But as I was doing background work in preparation for our conversation, easy to find articles in local newspapers in North Carolina that there's a conversation underway for the flagship at UNC Chapel Hill, which is now at 18%, again, increasing the number of out-of-state students. The public explanation is it's not just for money, but it's also to expand the talent pool and the diversity of the student population. How well does that argument play out when money seems to cast the larger shadow?
Yeah. Well, thanks for the question, and I also want to thank Scott for his very cogent response to your last question. It's quite right. In North Carolina, I think that's partly the issue that you heard being discussed by the officials at UNC. It has been an issue for quite some time. That is that with an 18% cap and looking at other flagships around the nation that have the opportunity to have a more diverse student body, there are educationally sound reasons to move a bit beyond an arbitrary 18%. At the same time, because of educational quality reasons, at the same time, as state budgets retract, and as different things occur in the state legislature, it makes recruiting out of state and internationally more important for budgetary reasons. But in North Carolina in particular there's been some tinkering with the budget that would have some of the state some of the dollars collected for tuitions revert back to the state entirely and not necessarily to go for educational purposes. So there's other reasons for North Carolina to be considering out of state enrollment based upon where their tuition dollars
are. Jerry, some of the angst and anger is obviously directed at seats. As Scott said, my kid couldn't get in at flagship university. But also there seems to be angst and anger that not only could my kid not get in, the state university gave financial aid to that kid who was not a state resident. I mean, how much aid is really involved, and how big of an issue is the aid issue in the larger context of this conversation?
Well, yeah, I think there's a lot of aid involved in many different areas. We've seen a decrease in aid going to needy students and an increase in aid going to leveraged students to get them to enroll in order to create net tuition revenue. This was a lesson well learned by the public institutions, and they're applying it all of the time. And critics of this are correct to be worried about it, not just for this argument, but for the entire argument of educational equity.
Scott, are there other metrics we should be looking at other than GPAs and AP scores and in-state and out-of-state or offshore students in this conversation?
Absolutely. I mean, part of the pressure on places like UNC Chapel Hill and University of Virginia is within their in-state population, who are they admitting? I'm here based in Washington, and in the Northern Virginia suburbs, there's a sense that it's harder for them to get into UVA than it is for somebody from a rural part of Virginia. But the reality is legislators care deeply throughout that state and throughout most states about whether students from all parts of the state are being admitted, whether low-income students are being admitted, whether minority students are being admitted in some relationship to what the minority population of the state looks like. If you go to University of Michigan, highly competitive admissions, and people will ask, how many did you admit from the Upper Peninsula? So a lot of this, you know, the out-of-state is getting attention right now, but the reality is a good flagship could probably admit all of its students highly qualified from a relatively small subset of high schools in the state. So they're already doing quite a balancing act.
But it also seems that you've both mentioned this, the issue of equity and access to low-income students. I know here in Los Angeles, where both Jerry and I live, the crosstown rivalry between UCLA and USC at times also plays out in terms of the income profile of the entering freshman class. There have been many years where USC, the private institution, boasts that that UCLA has a higher income profile as the public crosstown public institution than UCLA is the USC is the private institution. Jerry, that one goes to you.
Well, I think I'm not sure what to do with that one, quite frankly, Casey. I mean, I think both institutions do an awfully good job of trying to provide student aid to needy students. From my view, I think that the impact you heard just there has to do with a recruitment effect. But I think you're seeing UCLA in particular now make extraordinary strides in the area of low-income students, and do so without the ability to use race as any kind of a factor as a result of the way the California propositions work. USC has a long tradition of serving the city that it's in, so I think both of those institutions are feeling very sensitive to that particular issue.
Well, at the risk of dwelling on California, UC President Janice Neapolitano has said that she's going to review this issue. It's been in a lot of the local newspapers. We see that there's articles in newspapers in other geographies, in other states, about how to deal with the in-state, out-of-state issue, and obviously the revenue issues that come with that. But it doesn't look like there's a way out of this. I mean, you can move the numbers and set caps, 18% at North Carolina, which seemed to be under 10% in California, the issue in Iowa where there are financial incentives and penalties along the way. But the reality is that there's this large pool of potential revenue that accrues with out-of-state students that, given the dramatic decline in state funding, again, a real dollar decline of 23% from 2008 to 2013 across the country in terms of state operating support for public institutions, it doesn't go away, or does it? I mean, is there a way out of this? Scott, let me turn to you on this one in terms of, is there a way out in terms of what you're seeing and reporting in Inside Higher Ed?
I mean, there's not an immediate way out, but I think what your question points to is the underlying issue here is the state role in higher education. The idea of a preference for in-state students was based on the idea that the state was supporting undergraduate education. While our great public universities still get a lot of money, a lot of their money is coming from the federal government for research support and from tuition revenue. And as the percentage of operating budget declines from the state, they are naturally looking elsewhere. And so really the real issue here is, what is the state responsibility to higher education, and what can the state's citizens expect in return for that responsibility. Unfortunately, we're just talking primarily about my kid didn't get in, and that doesn't get to the root cause of this debate.
And Jerry, to the my kid didn't get in, and maybe that kid from out of state got some money from the state institution where I pay taxes, is there a way out of this Congress? Is there a way out?
You know, I think Scott's right. I think also there's two things to think about here. One is the one way out is that the institutions have to take responsibility as well. I mean, if they're state institutions, they need to do some work self-regulating, and that may in part mean not turning their back on revenue streams and streams that bring in new and interesting students, but butting the bullet and growing.
All right.
That's the only way that I see out.
All right, and with that, we're going to have to end. I want to thank you both. I want to thank Jerry Lucido at USC, Scott Jasek, for a very energetic and informative conversation about dealing with the revenue issues and the politics of out-of-state students. Two, I want to thank Sean Decatur, president of Kenyon College, and Eric Stoller, who's a social media strategist and blogger at Inside Higher Ed, for a very informative conversation about anonymous offensive blog posts. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or podcast early afternoons on most Fridays. On the web, we're available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about this week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.